The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
It's not just about the nukes. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. Nuclear talks with Iran look set to extend beyond tonight's deadline. For Iranians, the stakes are huge.
This is about so much more than Iran's nuclear program. This is about easing its pariah status, showing that it can be part of a productive negotiation with the international community.
Also, Nigeria's president concedes defeat today after a very close election.
Speak to Nigerians and they'll tell you, you know, this is a sign that you can vote out an unpopular government.
And Chinese luxury car buyers know what they want.
They like to be driven more than they like to drive. And that means they need a spacious, well-appointed back seat.
In other words, your daddy's Lincoln. Plus, Ben and Jerry's gets creative for Passover ahead on the world.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. History in the making today, in fact, history already made in Nigeria. In a few minutes, we'll hear from there about a first for Nigeria, a presidential election followed by a peaceful concession by the incumbent. But first, history still waiting to be made. In Lausanne, Switzerland, the nuclear talks between Iran and Western powers led by the U.S. are now set to continue into tomorrow. The State Department announced that enough progress has been made to warrant going past today's midnight deadline. Earlier, I spoke with Iran watcher Barbara Slavin. She's author of one of the classic books on U.S.-Iranian relations, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. And Slavin is pretty confident there will be a deal in the end.
I think they will come out of this clearly with something. How specific that's going to be is really the question. Is it going to be specific enough to quell some of the critics, particularly in the U.S. Congress, that this is a negotiating process that's worth having? Or is it going to be so specific that it's going to cause problems for the Iranian negotiators in Iran? That's what we're all waiting to see. But there will be something.
Chances are the headline will be deal and very few specifics, with more to come in the coming months, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll even use the word deal or if it'll be understanding or statement of principles. It's going to be something vague and probably in diplo speak. But, you know, there should be at least the outlines of what the Obama administration has been trying to get, namely cutting off the four pathways to a bomb and a one-year breakout.
So explain briefly four pathways to a bomb and one-year breakout.
Okay, so the four pathways are connected with places, at least the first three are. And the fourth is the covert pathway. And here, what I think you're going to hear from the Obama administration and the other negotiators is that an agreement will include very, very stringent verification measures, such that it would be really difficult for Iran to cheat and to find a covert pathway to a bomb. So I would expect that those four pathways would be touched on in this statement or understanding or whatever you want to call it. And then we will have until June the 30th to finalize all the technical details in terms of how they meet these objectives.
In terms of sticking points, though, would you say those four pathways are kind of what is being juggled with in Lausanne?
Well, the other part I didn't mention, of course, is sanctions relief. And
right.
That is the big sticking point. In return for agreeing to all of these restrictions for 10 or 15 years, the Iranians want sanctions relief. And in particular, they want very rapid removal of the United Nations Security Council resolutions that put Iran in the nuclear doghouse some years ago. And there's still a lot of finagling going on, to use diplo speak, in terms of how these sanctions would be eased. Would they be suspended for a period of time and then formally lifted? I think that's what the preference would be, again, for the Obama administration. The Iranians obviously are trying to get a promise that these sanctions will be lifted very, very soon and lifted permanently. So I think that's the major agreement that has kept the negotiators up all night. There also were some disputes about research and development, what would be allowed for Iran.
Now, the notion that these negotiators are up all night hashing this out, are we to understand that sanctions have hurt Iran so bad that even if there were some sticking points they weren't happy with, they're not going to leave that table because they want those sanctions lifted, or at least some of them?
Well, the Iranians, of course, are notoriously hard bargainers. And this is, I mean, talk about a crucial negotiating process. This is about so much more than Iran's nuclear program. This is about getting Iran out of the doghouse in terms of other issues as well, easing its pariah status, showing that it can be part of a productive negotiation with the international community. And you only really get, I mean, in terms of the comprehensive deal, they have to get this right. So I think I understand why the Iranian negotiators are fighting so hard to get as much out of this as possible. They have to go back and present it to Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, and say, look, you know, not just this was the best we could get, but that this is a win-win. This is a victory for us, too.
Barbara Slavin there, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of a book on the U.S. and Iran called Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. Let's get an Iranian perspective on all of this now. Syed Hossein Mousavian knows a bit about how Tehran is going about forging a deal with Washington. Just a decade ago, he was a spokesman for Iran in its nuclear negotiations. These days, Mousavian is a research scholar at Princeton University, and he's optimistic about the prospects for a nuclear agreement, but he still insists on what he calls Iran's right to enrich uranium.
Enrichment does not mean or is not equal to nuclear bomb. This is really a misleading narrative for public opinion. You cannot tell them, disassemble all your investment, hundreds of millions of dollars, thousands of employees, nuclear scientists. In many countries, they have enrichment. They have peaceful nuclear program.
Mr. Mousavian, I'm curious, and maybe you can tell us briefly, after having spent years of your life at the negotiating table on behalf of the Iranian government, just what this moment means to you.
I believe this is the historical moment, because for the first time since the founding of Islamic Republic of Iran, there have been many efforts to improve relations between Iran and the United States of America, and all have failed. These nuclear talks is the most significant interaction between Iranian and American diplomats since the days of the Shah, and is going to be successful. To my understanding, this talk would lead to a result. Iran and the U.S. have huge, huge responsibilities and communalities in the Middle East. They have the same position in Iraq, supporting the same government. Iran and the U.S., they are supporting the same government in Afghanistan for over a decade. They are in the same boat fighting ISIS. The U.S. is leading the airstrike. Iranians are the key element on the ground forces fighting ISIS. Therefore, I think if we can have nuclear deal, we would be able to think about a new Middle East.
Yeah, well, this deal is highly consequential in that respect, for sure. Mr. Mousavian, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
Please, go ahead.
Because you climbed pretty high up the ladder in Iran's government and served on its National Security Council for 8 years, starting in 1997. And I got to say, if I didn't know better, it sounds like you're still a spokesman for Iran. But in 2007, you were arrested by the Ahmadinejad administration and publicly accused of espionage. How do you understand that episode today?
This is because of political, internal political fightings. Three judges, they cleared me, and ultimately I was cleared from espionage charges. In Iran, I cannot hide that we have two major political wings, like Democrats in the U.S. and Republicans in the U.S., that they are continuously challenging each other. The Iranian domestic situation is very much like the U.S. domestic situation.
That's the not position, a very high compliment.
Look at the Congress. Almost our parliament is the same. Mm. Look at the fighting between Democrats and Republicans. In Iran, also principalists or conservatives, they have the same type of challenging fighting with the moderates. I tolerated the accusation of Ahmadinejad because I knew ultimately I would win the court and he would understand he made a big mistake.
And so those vicious internal politics in Iran, is that a system you want to return to and be part of someday?
This is my country, whether I like it or not. I'm really happy because it is not like countries like Saudi Arabia, that there is no political parties, there is no political wings. We have election, we have about 3,000 papers, magazines, we have different ideas. I believe we would bring Iran and the regional powers and the international community, the world powers, to a type of cooperation, cooperate for peace, stability, and security in the region.
Syed Hossein Mousavian, a research scholar at Princeton University and a former spokesman for Iran in its nuclear negotiations, thank you very much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Now to the history that was made in Nigeria today. President Goodluck Jonathan has officially conceded his defeat in the election that was held over the weekend, which means there will be a peaceful democratic transfer of power in Nigeria. That is the historic part, as my BBC colleague Will Ross told me from Lagos.
This is a first for Nigeria and a hugely significant moment. Never before has a sitting president been voted out. And the fact that we hear President Goodluck Jonathan phoned the opposition's Muhammadu Buhari to congratulate him is a massive moment for Nigeria. And everybody hopes that it will calm down the tension. This country has been extremely tense over the last few months, with both parties really fighting very hard with extraordinary amounts of money spent to win. It was a fairly close contest, although it was very clear over the last 12 hours or so that President Goodluck Jonathan was going to struggle to narrow the gap after the former military ruler, General Buhari, opened up quite a considerable lead. But it does seem to be a sign of deepening democracy when you look back at all the coups that have taken place over the years, as well as so many rigged elections. This is a sign that you can vote out an unpopular government.
Yeah, what did, if there is a final vote tally at this point, did it break down along north-south lines in Nigeria?
Yes, we had a very polarized society in some ways. Muhammadu Buhari, a Muslim candidate from the north, and Goodluck Jonathan, a Christian from the south. In places like Lagos, which is a huge city of close to 20 million with a big mix of people from all over, there all the results are mixed up. But it still seems there are many people here who do make their minds up based on religion and on region. But maybe that will start to end. It'll all depend on how the next government tries to govern for the entire country. And I think now the politicians know that they can be held accountable. You know, that's why this is so significant. For all these years, there's been so much looting going on over the last few decades. There's been so little done for the people. And now, as long as the Electoral Commission stays independent the way it was during this poll, that sword hanging over the politicians' necks, if you like, that if you don't perform well and not doing things in the interests of the people, or you know, you can have a nasty shock and get booted out.
Buhari favored perhaps by the North because he is a son of the North, but I'm also wondering, did he offer to the whole country some kind of solution to the violence that Boko Haram has been reaping for so long now?
Yes, he is a former military man, and he says he's got what it takes to boost the morale of the troops and try to ensure that there are no more situations like we've had over the last 9 months with, you know, large chunks of territory of Nigeria being overrun by jihadists. It will be a difficult task when this next government takes over. Not till the end of May. There's a strange period now where the President Jonathan stays in office until May the 29th.
That fact alone, Will, that this election ended in a civil manner, how are Nigerians reacting to that, even the Goodluck Jonathan supporters?
I think, you know, we're not out of the woods yet in terms of the tension dissipating. There were calls from some of the president's allies, you could say, but people who have benefited from his presidency, people like former militants in the Niger Delta down in the oil-rich area, they said they wouldn't accept anything but a victory for the president. And maybe some of the people who are very disappointed may want to vent their anger, but let's hope not.
Yeah, for sure. The BBC's Will Ross in Lagos, thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome.
Still up on the program, digging back 1,000 years for a page from a medieval medical book to cure MRSA on the world. I'm Marco Werman with The World, and hit it, Bruce.
Just
General Motors is hoping that luxury car buyers in China love Cadillacs as much as Bruce Springsteen did. GM is getting ready to unveil a new luxury sedan designed specifically with Chinese consumers in mind. Same with Ford. They're reintroducing the Lincoln Continental in part because of the Chinese market. We asked John Stoll to explain why this is happening. He's the Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal.
It's maybe a stereotype at this point, but for a long time what the automakers have found is that Chinese luxury buyers, when you get up to a certain class of buyer, they like to be driven more than they like to drive. And that means they need a spacious, well-appointed back seat, you know, reclining as if they were in a first-class cabin, room to put more than just a cup of coffee. In fact, the new Continental has room for a bottle of champagne if that's what you want, you know, while you're driving.
You mean not like a coffee cup holder, but a champagne bottle holder?
That's right. Yeah, and this is following the Germans. The Germans have been very careful to make sure that it's an experience in the back seat. Now, you know, when you're sitting there and you're doing business or you're traveling across country, whatever it is you're doing, there is this expectation that I'm essentially in my own airliner, for better or worse. I mean, that's kind of been the equivalence right now. And so, yeah, you know, Mercedes has gotten ahead of this. General Motors and Ford are taking their cues from the Germans.
Well, we've been hearing about the shrinking Chinese economy. Are GM
right.
and Ford not thinking about the possibility that maybe there won't be that many people to buy these luxury cars in a few years?
Well, right. The outlook for the Chinese auto market is growth, but lower growth. So we're not talking about the big, you know, double-digit growth that we've seen for a long time. We're talking about a growth rate that may be more like 5%. That's still pretty good when the global sales are maybe 3%. So it's outperforming the global market. What's important about that growth is so much of that is seen coming from the higher end and a preference for non-Chinese brands.
So the Cadillac and the new Lincoln Continental, the kind of retweaked for the Chinese market, have you seen either of these?
I have. I've sat in the Lincoln and had a pretty nice deep dive on the CT6, which is the Cadillac. They're two different executions. The Cadillac story has been a lot about performance. Think BMW in an American sort of, you know, suit. With a bigger car now, they'd like to have the mix of performance and ride and handling. Not quite the bouncy Cadillac DeVilles that we probably remember from the 1970s and 80s, but not quite the taut driving machines that BMW is well known for. So they're trying to get a little bit more comfort into the scene. The Lincoln Continental is interesting. I grew up in the, you know, backseat of a Lincoln while my mom drove me to school every day. We had Lincoln Continentals. And I sat in the back of this new one, and I'll tell you, it feels a lot like where they were going with the Lincolns before Lincoln kind of lost its mojo in the 1980s.
And where were they going? Kind of big,
they had
cushy
chrome,
seats, way down low?
Yeah, exactly. Plush, chrome. They've taken it to the next level. They've got really high-tech features in this thing, such as you hit a button and the windows can automatically frost. And so it gives a level of privacy to especially the person in the back seat who may be better known. What Lincoln says they're going to do is create a whole new platform, one platform for the entire world, and it's really customized for China, and then they go from there. So the American buyer is experiencing more what the Chinese buyer wants versus it being the other way around.
John Stoll is the Detroit bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much.
You bet, anytime.
Okay, it's spring for real now, I think. So let's play an ice cream game. Strangest flavor you ever tried. For me, it's got to be sun-dried tomato gelato. But hang on, Ben & Jerry's has a new flavor out. Just in time for the Jewish holiday of Passover, which starts on Friday. Can't get it here in the U.S., though. Here's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
The limited edition flavor is a pint of creamy vanilla ice cream with a swirl of something called charoset. It's one of the ritual foods eaten at the Passover meal. Passover marks the biblical story of the Exodus from Egypt, and charoset is meant to symbolize the mortar the ancient Israelites used when they were slave builders. It comes from the Hebrew word for clay, which may not sound like a very good ice cream ingredient, but people are screaming for this stuff.
This is where the ice cream is coming out.
Avi Zinger runs the Ben & Jerry's factory in southern Israel. It's the only Ben & Jerry's factory in the world where you'll see workers touching the mezuzah, the Jewish prayer affixed to the doorpost, before taking their seat on the production line. Zinger says the phone has been ringing off the hook at Ben & Jerry's headquarters in Vermont. Americans are desperate for a Passover pint. But the flavor is only being sold in Israel, just for the holiday.
People are calling Vermont, where they can get it, and it's not available. Actually, we get calls from Vermont regarding, you know, what is it? Because nobody understands what charoset is.
You mean that the people working in headquarters in Vermont are calling you, figuring out what is this flavor that you guys have made?
Yeah, you know, because they're not familiar with charoset.
Charoset is a kind of fruit and nut compote. It's not the first time the Ben & Jerry's here has put out a charoset ice cream. One year, they experimented with a flavor that they called matzah crunch.
We took a chocolate-covered matzah and we added it into our vanilla ice cream, and it was a big success. But unfortunately, the matzah, after a while, it gets very soggy. You know, the product wasn't as good as it's supposed to, so we didn't do it anymore.
To the flavor graveyard.
Yeah, it was straight to the flavor graveyard.
If you've been to the Ben & Jerry's factory in Vermont, you've seen the flavor graveyard, a row of tombstones for discontinued flavors. So how does the charoset flavor size up?
Okay, for the taste test.
Very cinnamony. It's very cinnamony, and there's a little taste of red wine.
Yeah, it's red wine, apples, dates, and cinnamon.
It's a blend of charoset recipes, the Ashkenazi version from Europe and the Sephardic version from the Middle East.
To me, it sounds like a mix of the Ashkenazi and the Sephardi. The
yeah.
Sephardi one is based on dates, and the Ashkenazi is based on apples, nuts, and cinnamon.
Okay, whatever it is, as long as people like it.
A group of kids who did a blind taste test for an Israeli newspaper were not too impressed. But some teenage boys I met, who came to the factory's ice cream shop looking for the charoset flavor, attacked a pint of it with plastic spoons.
Your honest opinion?
It's nice. It's like actual charoset, only in ice cream.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
The flavor experts at Vermont headquarters, the flavor gurus as they're called, were not actually involved in the making of this Passover flavor. In the true spirit of Israeli irreverence, the local factory sort of did it on its own. Actually, this local factory has long been a pioneer. In the late 80s, just as Ben & Jerry's was becoming successful, Avi Zinger took a ski trip to Vermont, fell in love with the ice cream, and got Ben & Jerry's to let him open a factory here in Israel. This and a factory in the Netherlands are the only two Ben & Jerry's factories outside of the U.S. So you may be wondering what next year's Passover flavor is going to be.
I think we, after this year, we had enough of those flavors, because people are very upset that they cannot find it and it's not available, and so they say forget it. I don't know what will happen next year.
Don't expect gefilte fish food next year. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, the Ben & Jerry's factory in Be'er Tuvia, southern Israel.
Later on The World, 6 seconds of soul drumming heaven. 1,500 bands can't be wrong, or can they? On The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, writer Ayan Hirsi Ali says Islam needs reform because too many Muslims are afraid to question their faith.
Anyone within Islam who puts question marks on theology gets ostracized, gets silenced, gets killed, gets labeled, you know, mad. So I think the time is now to talk.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I spoke with Rod Nordland from the New York Times today. He spent the last few days in Tikrit with Iraqi soldiers. The Iraqi army has been fighting for weeks to retake Tikrit from ISIS extremists. And for a few minutes during my conversation with Rod, I got a sense of how hard it is to know the truth when you're covering war. While we talked, the cable news headlines read, Iraq's government says it's forced ISIS from Tikrit. After all, that's what Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi had announced. But listening to Rod Nordland, just back in Baghdad after his trip to Tikrit, you get another reality altogether.
Man, the first time the Iraqi authorities said ISIS fell was last July. I happened to be here then as well. And we reported it. We scrambled to confirm it. Then it turned out not to be true. You know, they put the flag up over the government headquarters and said it was all but defeated. There were a couple little pockets to wipe out. Now we've been hearing the same thing over again this time. In fact, today the prime minister just announced that southern and western parts of Tikrit had fallen and the rest of it was about to fall. You know, I've just spent the last few hours actually on the phone talking to our sources up there and checking that out. And it turns out, once again, it's not true.
So there's obviously some disconnect between Tikrit and what the Iraqi government wants to say or feels what's going on up there. What's it like when you get back to Baghdad? Does it feel kind of like La La Land?
I think a little bit, yeah, because people don't know what to believe. And not just Baghdad either. I mean, I've just been fending off Twitter onslaughts today from people that are convinced that it's fallen and we're covering it up or something. And to some extent, you know, war is about propaganda and everything, but it doesn't serve your interests at all to tell your people you've taken something when you haven't, because eventually they're going to find out that you haven't, and they're not going to believe anything you say in the future anyway.
Mosul has kind of been characterized as the grand prize to get back from ISIS, but it's starting to sound like Tikrit is just as important, even as kind of like a staging area for an attack on Mosul.
Well, they can't take Mosul unless you've taken Tikrit. I mean, it's right on the main highway to Mosul. Tikrit has like a quarter million people, or had a quarter million people. Mosul it not only has more than a million, but they're still all mostly still living there. There's also the little problem of Anbar, which sits sort of behind and to the west of Tikrit. You know, if they go into Mosul without having subdued ISIS positions in much of Anbar, they're going to have somebody on their rear and their flank that they're going to have to worry about. So there's a long road to go, that's for sure.
So on the ground, there's this kind of hodgepodge of Iraqi army, Iranian advisors assisting Shia militias, the U.S. kind of in a supporting role but standing back as far as Tikrit goes. How does that mix all play out on the ground?
Well, it's a very confused mixture. The one thing that's clear is that the Iranian advisors have all disappeared from the scene. We didn't see any, and if they were there, they were really keeping themselves scarce because the Americans do not want to appear as if they're operating as Iran's air force. But it is quite a mixture. I mean, there are a lot of different Shiite militias that have different agendas. Some of them are frankly and historically even very anti-American, for instance. Some of them have even threatened to shoot at American planes, although that has not happened. But at the end of the day, the Iraqi military just does not have enough forces of regular army troops to do it by themselves.
So, Rod, what's next for Tikrit? And when is the Iraqi government going to start getting more in line with the Tikrit narrative that sounds more like what you've seen?
You know, I don't know. I think probably it'll be a long, drawn-out affair. They'll plan on the airstrikes to keep wearing away at ISIS whenever they pop up, and eventually they'll wear them down enough that the ground forces can go in and take the city without huge casualties.
It's curious. I mean, just as we're speaking, CNN is throwing out what the Iraqi government is saying, that Tikrit has fallen.
Yeah. I've spent all afternoon checking it out to make sure maybe I was wrong or something. But, you know, our sources are all saying they've made some advances. They've taken a few buildings. They've taken some parts of the palace, Saddam's old palace, which is a kind of fortified facility and very important militarily, therefore. But they haven't taken all of it. And, you know, that's been the case for some time now. You know, I'll believe it when I see it, when we can actually see civilians walking into the center of Tikrit. But I don't think that's the case now.
The New York Times' Rod Nordland speaking with us from Baghdad. Saudi Arabia is one of several Arab nations that have joined the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS extremists. The Saudis have helped with airstrikes in Syria. But Saudi Arabia is one of the most conservative Muslim countries in the world, and some say it actually stokes the ideology that fuels extremist Islam in the first place. The kingdom has also struggled to keep Saudi youth from joining extremist groups like ISIS. My colleague at the BBC, Barbara Plett-Usher, reports from Riyadh.
Just outside Riyadh, young Saudi men come to the desert to have a good time, play a bit of music, churn up the sand in dune buggies and four-wheel drives. They don't look like the kind who would join the so-called Islamic State, but chances are they know someone who has. Mishan Al-Onzi tells me a friend of his is fighting with ISIS in Syria, but there aren't many Saudis who support the group. If so, the kingdom wants to keep it that way, says the Ministry of Interior spokesman General Mansour Al-Turki.
Whoever made ISIS actually made it for purposes, and one of those purposes is really to attack Saudi Arabia. They know very well that our borders are very well protected. So their idea actually is to do their best through propaganda, like inspire young Saudis to carry out any terrorist act on their behalf.
The advance of ISIS has shaken the kingdom. Until recently, it stood accused of empowering Islamist militants in Syria by permitting funding from sympathetic sheikhs. But now, ISIS has declared it a prime target. And the clerics have been mobilized in the fight against the group, condemning it as un-Islamic in Friday prayers. But that doesn't include any soul-searching of their ultra-conservative creed, one that advocates harsh Islamic punishments taken to extremes by ISIS, or Fahash, as Prince Turki Al-Faisal calls them. He's a former intelligence chief.
How can Saudi Arabia's criticism of ISIS be taken seriously if it sentences a blogger to 1,000 lashes for insulting Islam? Is that so different?
This is the basic problem we have with media like yourselves in mixing apples and oranges. Fahish is a terrorist group. It has no legal system. The kingdom is a state. The kingdom has a judicial system that traces its history even longer than English common law.
So this is a human rights office?
Yes.
Who sits there and what happens there? We were given rare access to that judicial system, a high-security prison said to be holding ISIS inmates, but it was a tightly restricted tour. So the prisoners put complaints in the box about what their treatment, about...
About anything you wanted.
Torture?
Alhamdulillah.
This was part of Saudi efforts to push back against allegations of torture. We were shown a state-of-the-art hospital, a library, a solitary confinement cell, all empty. We didn't speak to any prisoners, apart from the one they selected for us. 45-year-old Manaa Nasser told us he'd gone to Syria to do relief work and had been forced to join ISIS.
They threatened they would kill me if I didn't disown the Saudi royal family and the Arab leaders. I was forced to pledge loyalty to them and follow their doctrine.
We are approaching one of our posts, and there is a surveillance tower. It has a camera and radar and communication, too.
We've arrived now at the Saudis' front line against ISIS, the windswept desert border with Iraq. They've strengthened it with a double fence, monitored by high-tech surveillance cameras.
We will go to the right, and you will be able to see the fence and the concertina wires. And this area, only no man's land, only border guard supposed to be here.
The Saudis have fortified themselves against extremist attacks and tried to reform militant recruits, but they're not questioning if their ideology is in any way to blame.
BBC's Barbara Platt Usher reporting there from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. So how can peaceful Muslims stop other Muslims from committing terrorism in the name of Islam? Depends on whom you ask, that much is sure. Our next guest on The World says nothing short of a complete reformation of Islam will do the trick. Ayan Hirsi Ali was raised a Muslim by her Somali parents, but she's turned her back on the religion when she moved to the Netherlands as a refugee and became a politician there. Now she's here in Boston, a fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she has a new book out called Heretic. In it, she argues that Islam desperately needs reform because the faith, as it's practiced now, encourages intolerance and discourages questioning. She also recalls first learning about Muslim doctrine from a schoolteacher in Kenya named Sister Aziza.
At first, you know, my classmates and I would giggle when she asks, how do I know you're a Muslim? How can I tell the difference between you and the other Christian girls in the school? And, you know, that would have us thinking. So I thought, and this is all in hindsight, but I found her to be very persuasive. And she was asking us, look, if you're a Muslim, then you have to behave like a Muslim. And we would go through the list of what is halal, that which is permitted, and what's haram, that which is forbidden. And so if you neglected to do your obligations, cover yourself, pray 5 times a day, do not take the Christians and the Jews as your friends. She just gave us these choices, but the way she did it was, you're not doing it for me, you're not doing it for your parents, it's fi sabilillah, you're doing it for the sake of Allah, and you're investing, and you need to do these things to invest in the hereafter.
When you look back on this period where Sister Aziza presents you with this dichotomy, what strikes you and how you receive this information?
When I read the Quran, what she was saying was in there, so I had no reason to doubt her. It was up to me. The challenge was, and that's probably what they call the inner struggle, when some people are describing jihad, the inner struggle was to be able to follow the rules as much as possible. So praying 5 times a day, if you're 15 years old, living in Kenya with all the distractions and all the temptations out there, is extremely difficult. As I joined this debate and it became, well, it's Islamic, it's not Islamic, what motivated? I started to put together, again, very much in hindsight, that these preaching teachers who entered our lives awakened a desire in Muslim believers that went from just believing and from being spiritual to being warrior-like. And I had to then confront myself and my conscience with the question, okay, it's true what the preaching teacher is saying. This is in the Quran. But if I'm given a command in the Quran, what if I don't approve of it? And that puts you, you know, in a mental state where you have to argue with God. And as Muslims, we're not used to the concept of arguing with God. We submit, and we submit completely. And constantly it is, and this, I was going through this mentally, if I disobeyed Allah and if I didn't take the Quran literally, then I would risk going to hell after I die. And that led to the question, of course, and that's the central question, is there hell? Is there heaven? Are we going to, is there life after death? And for me personally, I answered that question with a no, which then liberated me from this incredible fear of the afterlife.
Don't you get equally upset, though, when you see, like, the pastor from the Westboro Baptist Church who burned Qurans, you know, his version of screaming fire in a crowded theater, or like the Haredim Jews in Jerusalem who feel they have the right to spit at or throw stones at women who wear trousers in their neighborhood?
This book is not about getting upset. This book is a proposal for change. The Muslim world is up in flames. It's a major crisis. And I think that the best thing is not to run away from it and look for comparisons with fringe groups in Judaism and Christianity, but to look at this reality head on, especially for those of us who are born into Islam and in Muslim countries, and to say, you know, how can we bring about peaceful change? And that's the message of this book.
I mean, in your book, you call for a reformation of Islam. That sounds measured. It's reasonable. But at other times, you seem to be arguing that there's something inherently toxic about all interpretations of Islam. But all great religions can be used for good and evil, right?
In the case of Islam today, it's being used for evil. And the people who are doing it are succeeding in persuading young people. I mean, I just want to give you again the thousands of young men and women increasingly who are leaving peaceful, comfortable lives and going to Iraq and Syria to join the Islamic State.
But those young people are
how
not,
can we?
They're being attracted by radical Islam.
This is a minority view, that there is one Islam that's unreformed, but three sets of Muslims. And in the book, I describe these three sets of Muslims, the Medina Muslims, those are the ones who say religion is the answer. And then the largest number, the Mecca Muslims, who are religious, one more religious than the other, but who are sort of trapped in, should we go with Sharia law or should we go with secular law? And then you have a smaller group again, and that's what I find heartening, and that's why I'm optimistic, a growing group of Muslims who are actually risking their lives to say, we need to go forward with secular laws, man-made laws, and leave divine law behind us.
I imagine you have friends and relatives with dramatically different interpretations of Islam. Have you ever sat down with those who disagree with you, and kind of how do those conversations play out?
Oh, I do. I sit down with them all the time. In fact, the latest, and he's a very fair, he's not a family member, but he's become a dear friend, Majid Nawaz. And 3 years ago, he and I stood, you know, diametrically opposed to one another. And in our views, we debated one another. The proposition was Islam is a religion of peace. And he was saying it's a religion of peace. I was saying, no, it's not. Today, we don't agree. He's still a believing, practicing Muslim. I've become an apostate, a heretic, whatever you want to call me. But we feel today that it's really urgent that something needs to change within the religion. So it is not that I don't talk to Muslims or address Muslims. The point is, if you don't agree, talk it out. Don't threaten to kill one another. And Islam has been doing this for so long. Muslim apostates, anyone within Islam who puts question marks on theology gets ostracized, gets silenced, gets killed, gets labeled, you know, mad. So I think the time is now to talk.
Ayan Hirsi Ali is a Boston Globe contributor. Her new book is called Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Before the break, let me tell you about a photograph. A Syrian girl, her hands up in surrender, her eyes full of fear, and just 4 years old. Why her hands are raised is the heartbreaking part, and you can find out why at PRI.org. This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Fans of folk medicine will get a kick out of our next story. It's about MRSA, M-R-S-A, or methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. MRSA is the curse of modern medicine. It's an infection plaguing hospitals. It costs health services billions and kills many of its victims. As its name suggests, it's super resistant to antibiotics. But now there's a lead on a new potential remedy, one that's actually centuries old. And here to tell us about it is a professor of English, of all things, Christina Lee from the University of Nottingham in England. What have you found, Christina?
Well, we found that in an Anglo-Saxon leech book, which is from the 10th century, that there is a remedy, which is for a sty in the eye, that actually kills the bacteria that causes MRSA.
A remedy for a sty in the eye that kills MRSA. So what is that remedy?
That remedy is a combination of various subtle ingredients. You know, so there's some allium species, there's some wine. They are pounded together and they are then, you know, sort of added with a feather to the eye. And we actually found that this is very useful.
Wait a minute. So alliums, that's like garlic and onions. And you mix
Absolutely.
That with wine and then you put it in the eye with a feather?
Yes, that's what the recipe suggests. But obviously, we haven't done that yet. So what we have done is we have tried it on a chronic wound model a number of times. And we've also had some mouse trials. And they were all very, very interesting.
And when you say interesting, does that mean that MRSA was cured in these subjects? Or
yes. Yes.
Really?
Yes. We've seen, you know, so we've seen it being cured. We've really seen it, you know, it's been very effective against Staphylococcus.
So this was your idea in the first place? I mean, when the kind of brainstorm opened up.
It was a collaborative idea. It was just, you know, so that the science people said, in your period, people must have had infections. And I said, yes, of course they did. And they died of them. And they said, well, didn't they have anything against them? And I thought back, you know, so that there was this remedy. We all kind of, you know, sort of looked at it. And then we thought, okay, why not try this?
Yeah, so what is Bald's leech book, this reference guide that you turned to from long ago that had this recipe, this curative?
Okay, it's one of the Anglo-Saxon medical books. We have a number of Anglo-Saxon medical books, but this is a very unique one. There's only one manuscript from the mid-10th century. The collection may be a little bit earlier.
So the title, the leech book, suggests what? Leeches?
Leeches is the name for the medieval doctor. And we call it Bald's Leech Book because it tells us that the book was owned by someone called Bald.
So, Christina, what's the next step? I mean, how soon could we potentially see this cure at hospitals that are plagued with MRSA?
This is early doors still. We have found out that it is the sum of ingredients that works, but we now need to find out what exactly is working here. We are hoping that we can produce something soon, but of course, you know, we need to do some really thorough tests.
It is April Fool's tomorrow. You're not getting on the case early, are you?
Okay. We're
this is for real.
It is. My colleagues, Freya Harrison and Steve Diggle, who are partners in this project, are giving a big paper on that tomorrow. But we just thought, you know, it's probably not a good idea to break the story to the press on the 1st of April.
Christina Lee, Professor of English at the University of Nottingham, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there you have it, the past possibly providing some valuable information for modern medicine. Speaking of which, the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, recently did a little digging into the history of vaccines. Did you know that George Washington is also the founding father of mass immunization in America? Chris explains all in a video we've posted at PRI.org. Finally today, I want to play you a piece of music that you may very well recognize. Although you might have heard it in a slightly different form, like in this song. You're the fire starter, twisted fire starter. Or this one. Little wonder then, little wonder, you little wonder, little... Or hey, how about this one? Step off the train, I'm alone at dawn, back until the home where I was. What you just heard are three variations of what's known as the Amen Break. The original drum solo came from a song performed by a band called the Winstons. Amen, Brother was recorded in 1969, but since then, that six-second drum solo has been sampled on over 1,500 songs, including the songs we just played, Firestarter by Prodigy, David Bowie's Little Wonder, and Oasis with Do You Know What I Mean? But the Winstons never got a penny from all the artists who sampled their song. So now two British DJs are trying to correct that with a fundraising campaign for one of the surviving Winstons. Steve Theobald is one of the DJs behind this effort. He joins us now from Leicestershire in England. Steve, why do you care about this?
The Aim and Break is something I've been involved with indirectly for about the last 20 to 25 years through the hip-hop scene and the UK rave scene that was born from that. The Break has just been so influential in creating a genre, creating a unique sound. It's really, really important for the music industry as we know it today.
When you say you've been indirectly involved, does that mean you've actually sampled the Amen Break yourself?
Yes, I have. I'm not going to lie. It just gives that punch and that impact to whatever we're trying to do when you're making underground dance music or drum and bass or whatever you're doing.
You said, I'm not going to lie, as if maybe you felt a little bit guilty that you had used it and they didn't get money. But now you seem to be on the fundraising end of things. How much have you raised so far?
We've raised over £21,000.
It's a real massive achievement. $28,000.
Yeah, that's literally within a month.
Do you know if any of the artists who've sampled the Amen Break have also donated?
You know, we were trying to get Dr. Dre on it, but we've had no response from his people. It's more about the clubbers and the ravers. They've felt the beat. They've been touched by the beat, if you know what I mean. And what happens is when you go out to a club, it's instantly recognisable. It just goes to show the widespread versatility of what Mr. Coleman, who actually drummed the beat, he obviously hasn't realised the impact of what he's actually created here.
So Greg Coleman, the drummer who created this unforgettable riff in the first place, he's no longer with us.
Yes.
But Richard Spencer, also a member of the Winstons and the copyright holder of the song Amen Brother, was asked by the BBC how he felt about your efforts. And he had a great line. He said, 50 years on, some young white boys that I've never met halfway across the world said, we're going to give you a gift. It's probably one of the sweetest things that's happened to me in a long time. So, Steve, you've never met Richard Spencer, I guess.
Well, to be fair, up until about 6 months ago, I didn't even know that the man was alive. I thought the Winstons were all done and dusted, if you know what I mean. But I've been in contact with Richard since, and to hear him say something like that is incredible, really, because we're at the risk of going a bit serious. In a world that's full of, you know, bad news, there's not many people out there that want to do something just because they love something. Yeah, it just seemed the right thing to do.
Well, DJ Steve Theobald, speaking with us from Leicestershire, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As Steve mentioned, he's reached out to music producer Dr. Dre about using the Amen Break. And that's because one of the most famous songs that sampled it is this one. Whoa, put on the brakes, because that is all we can play on the radio of Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A. Sorry, Dre. That's our show today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor, by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.